Learn the key to making successful connections in the new global era with Michael Landers.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. It's great to see everybody. Some familiar faces and some people that I've not met before, but I do appreciate everyone making the trek out here, if it was a trek, and also like to acknowledge that it is International Women's Day, so I appreciate for people to come out for that as well. So we're here to talk a little bit about culture crossing, discovering the key to making successful connections in this new global era. And I'd like to just start out by telling you a little bit about myself. My life has been a series of culture crossings, as yours has been as well, I'm sure. But real quick, I'm originally from Boston. When I was 3 years old, my father moved us to Bogota, Colombia in South America. I lived in Colombia from the time I was 3 years old to the time I was 15, coming back to Boston every summer. Then we moved to Rio de Janeiro, Brazil for 2 years. Then we moved to Santo Domingo in the Dominican Republic for 1 year. So if you're doing the math, that's three high schools, 4 years, three different countries, coming back to Boston every summer. After undergrad in Miami, I moved to Japan. I lived in Japan for several years, working for a traditional Japanese company, and then helping Japanese doctors who were going to do sabbaticals in different countries around the world. I came back and got a master's degree in cross-cultural training, and then worked in international HR for several years. And for the last 15 years, I've been working on the East Coast in New York, as well as here in San Francisco since 2009, helping global companies become more globally effective, whether it might be leading globally, marketing globally, selling, managing, all those kind of things. And so this experience has really made me realize that life is a series of culture crossings for all of us. And when you have a culture crossing, two things can happen. One, we can have a culture connection. And when that happens, we get people. You might even say, yeah, I really like working with that person. They just get it. I like working at that organization. They just get it. And when we look at it, what do they get? They get your culture, right? And those are great. But the other thing that can happen is a culture crash. And culture crashes happen when you unknowingly or unwittingly might offend somebody, or you yourself might feel offended or disrespected. With a culture crash, I'm intending to be something, but the impact that my intention is having is not aligned. So I'm intending to be friendly, you see me as unfriendly. I'm intending to be assertive, maybe you see me as aggressive. Maybe you see me as passive. And culture crashes happen consistently in this new global era. I'm going to share a couple with you that we've seen recently. Culturally programming affects how we see things, right? So the reason that a crash is happening is because of my cultural programming. One of the things that I look at is we are no different than these lovely things. These are filled with code. That's what makes them work. But what happens to your device when it encounters other code it doesn't recognize? It crashes, right? It loses its ability to function. Now, luckily, we have engineers who go in, adapt the code, and what do they send you? An update, right? So what wasn't working is now working. Wonderful. Why are we no different? We are filled with code as well, but our code is cultural. When do you think you start to become culturally programmed? Birth, yeah? Actually, we see it as the third trimester. When the baby or the fetus can start to hear language, you start to become programmed. You're born, you're told pretty quickly what's good, what's bad, what's wrong, what's right. You go to school, it's reinforced. You're recognized or rewarded, maybe you're punished, okay? But you become culturally programmed. Now, what happens to us humans when we encounter other human cultural code we don't recognize? With an Apple device, you get the rainbow wheel. What does your rainbow wheel look like? For some people, they get frustrated, they get angry, they avoid the conflict, okay? But just like our devices, we lose our ability to function. So the question for you tonight is, who's gonna go in and give you an update? You will. What I'm gonna do tonight, and what the book will help you understand is, how are you culturally programmed? What's your code look like? Because when we're not aware of our code, we have culture crashes. And let's take a look at some high-profile ones that have happened recently. I try to stay partisan in all of these talks, and I will tonight as well. If you're not familiar, a couple weeks ago, our president met with the Prime Minister of Japan, Mr. Abe. And they shook hands for 19 seconds. During this handshake, our president lightly rubbed and tapped the Prime Minister's hand. Now, I believe that our president's intention was to show respect and kindness and warmth. Okay, that was his intention. But the impact that that had on the prime minister, if you've seen the video, is after about 19 seconds, the prime minister was smiling, doing his fake smile, okay, polite. But then after 19 seconds, he took his hand away and he rolled his eyes and went, oh my God. Okay, because he was feeling like that was disrespectful. It made him uncomfortable. And his cultural reflex was so strong that he couldn't even hide the eye roll in front of thousands of reporters. Something that he would never want to do, probably from a Japanese perspective, because it would cause him and the country to lose face. But his cultural reflex was so strong after having to hold President Trump's hand for 19 seconds and get pet like a hamster, he was like, oh my God. Oh, culture crash. Their intentions and the impact they had were completely misaligned. We saw this years ago too when George W. Bush met the king of Saudi Arabia and they went around Crawford Ranch in Texas holding hands. And they held hands as they walked around, just like this, for a while. Well, do you remember what the U.S. press said? They said, oh, W. Bush kowtowing to the Saudis, right? He should be stronger than that. What kind of man walks around with another man holding hands the whole time? What President Bush was doing, because he had done his homework, believe it or not, was correct. He was showing respect. If he had pulled his hand away early, the Saudi must have been like, what's wrong? Why don't you want to hold my hand? What's the problem here? I'm showing friendship and commitment to the relationship. So that really wasn't a culture crash from President Bush, but people's interpretation of it was. Here's another one. Lionel Messi. Most people would say, and I would agree, that he's probably the world's best soccer or football player. Okay, maybe. It could be. We're going to have a Real Madrid-Barcelona fight right in a second. No, está bien. Maybe one of the top two. But anyway, last year, Mr. Messi was approached by a group in Egypt, and they were like, we want to do some charitable thing. So what Messi did was agree to donate a pair of his used soccer boots or soccer shoes. Okay? So he goes on this TV show, and here we are giving his boots away for charity. And what do you think happened? Anybody guess? Huge insult. The press in Egypt went crazy, really, really angry. This is the biggest offense to the Egyptian culture in the history of Egypt. And Egypt's history goes back a long way. Okay? But it was a huge offense. Why? Shoes, dirty shoes, used shoes, lowest part of the body, huge offense. Was it Messi's intention to offend an entire nation? No, his intention was to show respect and give money, but they're like, we don't need your dirty shoes. We don't need your money. Take them back. Right? Again, culture crash. Intention, alignment, totally not. So here's a couple other ones that happened on the marketing. When Pepsi came out with their Come Alive with a Pepsi Generation and they released it to Taiwan. Again, intention, we're going to sell Pepsi's Come Alive with a Pepsi Generation. Lovely, this is really good. But they didn't do their research and translation. So this is what it came out as. Pepsi brings your ancestors back from the dead. All right, now some people were like, awesome, grandma. And other people were like, oh, hell no, not again. Never again. Okay. Again, major culture crash. Their intention was not to get people think you drink Pepsi and have their ancestors come back from the dead. It was to sell Pepsi. Another one, and there's lots of these, but just saw some kind of fun ones. Coors had a campaign years ago they called Turn It Loose. They mistranslated that into Spanish as Suéltate, which means suffers from diarrhea. Okay. Again, misalignments around that. So the reason why culture crashes tend to happen is really a lack of awareness. So how do we avoid them? One is becoming more aware of yourself. And let's take a look at our four stages of awareness. Our first one is unconscious incompetence, right? Which is you don't know that you don't know. Now, here's a question. A lot of us are in this stage multiple times in our lives. But how do you figure out that you don't know that you don't know if you don't know that you don't know that you don't know that you don't know? That's true, right? What has to happen? Somebody could point it out to you for sure. Hey, you know what? You're doing that wrong. Oh, cool. I didn't know that I didn't know. Right? The other thing that tends to happen is you fail or make a mistake. For those of you who work in Silicon Valley and startups, and you're an entrepreneur, we're seeing a big trend now, fail fast, fail forward. What is a beta? A beta is trying to recognize that we're unconsciously incompetent. What didn't we know about the test? So we do the test and we get the feedback back, great. But you have to fail, you have to make a mistake, and it's not something we like to do. But once we do realize that we know that we don't know that we don't know, we become consciously incompetent. Note you're still incompetent, but now you're conscious about it. And now you know that you don't. And I meet a lot of people in life who are stuck in this stage. They know that they don't know, but they're like, you know what? I don't really care. I'm just going to do my thing. We encourage people to get to conscious competence. And now you try and understand what you don't know, right? But the key here is you have to do it. It's your choice. You have to be accountable to try and understand what you don't know. And then you get through it and you become unconsciously competent and you know. Work, especially in the US culture, is all geared to get people to be unconsciously competent. Why do we send people to training? Why do we onboard people? And when we have people who have experience and have reached a certain level, they become unconsciously competent. We want people to be unconsciously competent at some level in their jobs. It doesn't mean you don't think about it, but you just flow. Think about an activity that you do that you're unconsciously competent in. You don't think about it anymore. Keep it PG. Driving. Wonderful. Have you always been unconsciously competent in driving? Anybody remember the first time you drove on a highway or a freeway? Right? I was going 25, 35 around my town, went on the on-ramp. I was 16. My mom was sitting next to me still because I had my learner's permit. White knuckle. Speedometer goes up to 55. My mom's like, watch out. I'm like, shut up, in a nice way. Okay? But I couldn't do anything else for those first couple of times. Have you ever driven, 10 minutes go by and you're at work or you're at your driveway and you're like, how did I get here? Unconscious competence. Right? Even turning the radio up was something I wasn't able to do early on. Now, I was doing a workshop in Texas a couple of years ago, and I was watching Today Show in the morning, and it was an interesting thing because they're talking about what people do when they drive. So they said 95% of US Americans do this one activity when they drive, at least once. Pick their nose. Disgusting, but guess what? When I was not competent in driving, I probably wouldn't have even done that, not even an inch, because I didn't want to let go of the steering wheel. 2% of the country, you know what they do? They change a baby's diaper. I was impressed. I'm like, one hand and okay, all right, maybe. But then what happens with the dirty thing? That was the question. Unconscious competence. Okay. You, myself, are unconsciously competent in our own culture. What does that mean? We have culture from a national perspective, right? I'm US American. I'm from Mexico. I'm from Brazil. But culture is also regional. When I moved to California, I learned about NorCal and SoCal. We lived in Southern California, then we moved up to Northern California. I saw a NorCal bumper sticker. I'm like, what is that? They're very different. Town culture, city culture, organization, engineering culture, sales culture, marketing culture. And then at the end of the day, you have you, your own personal culture. And we bring all of that to the table. So I believe you can be unconsciously competent in your own culture. I'm very familiar with other cultures, but I don't think about it in my own culture. But every time we cross cultures, be it personal, national, regional, local, where do you think it moves us in this scale? I know how to motivate people. I know how to sell. I know how to negotiate. I know how to build teams. All these things I know how to do because I've done it for a long time and I've been rewarded and recognized for it. But all of a sudden, I'm doing it across cultures and what I'm doing isn't working at all. So it puts us up to unconscious incompetence. And then we go through the list again. But if we don't know that we don't know, we get stuck in this loop. So another way we figure out what you don't know that you don't know is by testing your global IQ. In the last 12 years, I've done a similar workshop to over 15,000 people around the world. And I've asked people a series of 7 questions. So the data that I've gotten back from those questions is fascinating. So your test tonight is, what is a gesture that means the same thing in all countries and cultures? Smile. Okay, we'll talk about that in a second. Smile is technically a facial expression. It really isn't a gesture, but we allow it for this. Okay, what do you think the other one is? Head nod. Yeah. Okay. That's the answers. Okay, that's wrong too, but that's number one and number two. Now, here's the question for you. Why do you think those are number one and number two across all cultures? Why are those two gestures? Doesn't matter where I go or who we speak to. What has to happen for a gesture to be something that you recognize as the most popular, the most common? You have to see it a lot. So when's the first time you saw somebody smile at you? Hopefully when you were born, someone picked you up and was like, oh, and now we're like, oh, not another one, right? Like, oh, and then what did they do? They said, no, yeah. So you've seen the smile and the nod more times than you can probably even imagine, and it becomes part of your programming. And the deeper the programming, the harder it is to switch. But what I have figured out is when I'm talking to you here and I'm acknowledging that I'm listening to you, what do I do with my head? And in India and those places, maybe this is the same way, right? Also in Sweden, a lot of people, and I have Justin here who's from Sweden, will do this. Yup, yup, yeah, which means yes. And in the United States, what's up? And if I add this to it, what's up? Might mean something else, all right? So the head nod's number one. The other one is the smile. So in culture, we see spectrums of things. On one side, we have super smiley cultures, okay? And on the other side, we have not so smiley cultures. Where do you think the United States ranks? Oh my God, the most smiley culture. Hey, how's it going? How are you? Oh my God, have a Coke and a smile. Customer service with a smile, right? 80% of the time we smile here because we're happy or we want to show happiness or exuberance. 10% of the time we smile because I forgot your name. Hey, you, good to see you. What's her name? Okay. And the other percentage of the time we smile because we just don't like the person we're talking to. And we all have our fake smile. And when you're related to somebody, you know their fake smile. Oh, there he is. He's doing his fake smile again. There's Michael doing it. Okay. But here's an interesting thing about programming. I want all of you to think about having to hire somebody for your team. Okay. You need somebody on your team, a high performer. You send out job descriptions. You get all these resumes in. And then one comes across your desk that's perfect. And it's me. I'm exactly what you're looking for, education, years of experience, okay? You bring me into an interview, you have your 10 bulletproof interview questions. I answer them all exactly the way you want. It's perfect. It's a culture connection. Good fit for the company, I'm the right salary, everything. But I don't do one thing during the whole interview. I don't smile once. I want you honestly now to answer this. How many people in the room would still hire me? Okay, there's about 3 or 4 people. Why? For the people that didn't, not that you did anything wrong, but why not? Too serious. It looks like I'm not excited, okay? All right. Now, I'm trying too hard by not smiling. I'm not gonna be happy here, okay? If I go to a not so smiley culture, and again, I'll just throw out one country that we see this in. It doesn't mean everybody in this country does it, but we do see it a lot, and that's Russia, okay? The person who smiles at a job interview in Russia is very often considered the village idiot. Okay? And I don't make that up. These are in recruiting pamphlets that we see by people who study this. And I'll tell you a quick story. We've done some work with Airbnb over the years. And as they grew, they had to have community managers in different countries. If you're familiar with Airbnb, the community manager's job is to get people excited about Airbnb. So Airbnb originally wanted to hire the person in Russia. And who do you think they hired? Their prototype of the California community manager, who was like, oh my God, how are you? Do you want to list your, oh, this is great. You're going to love Airbnb. How do you think that person did in getting new people to host in Russia? Village idiots. Okay. So if I put the same question to you, and you might've been from a country that didn't smile that much or wasn't expecting it, the person who didn't smile would hire. That person who smiled during that interview, I would not hire. Right? Because in that country in particular, when you smile, it should be connected to a correct emotion. And if you're going for a job interview, why are you so excited? If you get the job, then okay, maybe smile. But beforehand, hey, how are you? So good to meet here. But here, we expect it. And it's so strong that when I've asked that question, I'd say 98% of people in the US do not raise their hand. So think about that from a cross-cultural interview bias perspective on the talent that you might be missing out on. And we see this with a lot of tech companies. And that's just one dimension of culture, the smile. So other gestures. We saw the nod. Okay, thumbs up. It's good for a lot of places. And other places, it's up yours. Okay? All right, so you have to be careful with it. So the answer to the question is, I have not found one yet. In 20 years of doing this, no gesture means the same thing in all cultures. Either there's an opposite meaning, like this, which is 5 for a lot of us, or stop. But in Greece, it's the mutsa, and this is a double mutsa, and it means I throw poop in your face. Right? And so you can imagine that Subway commercial in Greece, $5 foot long. You'd be like, oh, hell no, no extra on that one, man. And not the 6-inch or the 12-inch, okay? right? Something also as simple, Luciano, my friend from Brazil, will know this. A lot of American men, when they talk to people, especially in companies, like to do this. Okay, so we're going to do real well. We got a lot of sales going on this year, okay? And in Brazil, this means you're screwed, okay? We're going to build the best house for you. Don't you worry, okay? Again, right? So no gesture means the same thing in all cultures. Wonderful, interesting, kind of funny, too. There's not a gesture that means the same thing. Great. Everything that we do in the book and the work that I do has to be practical. So what do you do with that data? Maybe you just found that out for the first time. No gesture means the same thing in all cultures. What do you do with that data? How does that help you? Some people will be like, oh, I guess I should never gesture. And then I'm like, okay, but that would be weird because it's like, hi, welcome, come on in. He's not moving his arms. You know, it'd be weird, right? I'll do lots of research. Yeah, you're going to know every gesture around the world. It's hard. I applaud if you try to do that. It's difficult. But what can you do? You can observe people for sure, and mirroring's really important. What else can you do? Ask, and also self-awareness. Do you know what your personal top three gestures are? Do you know you sit like this? Hello, Rodin. Okay, don't move. It's okay. All right? Thinking about that, sir. Okay. Everyone's got your top three gestures. Do you know what they are? Most people wouldn't. Why is it important? One of mine, when I talk to people, is this. And my wife told me, hey, honey, you do this a lot. And I'm like, really? No idea. Wasn't a good thing for social functions, right? Hey, how good to see you too. Nice to meet you too. Now you're doing that. Okay. But your top three gestures, really important, because you don't want to be giving off the wrong feeling when it's not your intention. But again, we don't know them. So ask the person who spends the most time with you. They'll tell you what your top three gestures are, really important. The other thing, are you or could you be misinterpreting other people's gesture? I'll give you an example. Imagine you're talking to people and you come in and you go like this. Colin introduced me. I'm like, hey, everybody, good to be here. Thank you so much for coming. And I stand like this for the first 5 minutes. Seriously, what does this mean to you? Arrogance. Confrontational, yeah? And is this confidence for anybody? No? Okay, but some people are like, yeah. You know what this is for me? Peter Pan. I will not grow up. It isn't, okay? But what if it was? I come out going, exuberance, youthfulness, and you guys are like, asshole, right? Arrogant, cocky, just by doing this. How about this? What does this mean? All our pop psychology, what has this told you this means? Defensive and also like blocked off, right? Most people are like, oh, that's totally blocked off. Yeah, why? Did you read it somewhere? Somebody told us, right? So I've been doing these programs for all different types, people with PhDs, people with a high school education, people who work construction, to CEOs of companies. And a lot of people come in and they sit like this. Sometimes when I do workshops for construction workers, they come in and they sit like this. If I thought this meant that they were all blocked off, how could that affect my performance or my speaking? Oh my God, everyone's blocked off. I better bump up the energy. Hey guys, welcome. And they love being at training to begin with. So that would do really, really wonderful. No. So what I found is the reason people sit like this, because they're comfortable or they're cold for the most part. But again, we think from our own cultural programming, this must mean they're blocked off and that might affect how I behave. So again, knowing your three gestures, really important. Knowing other people's. And another tactic that we suggest is mirroring. If you're interacting with people from any culture and they are standing 2 feet apart from you, right? If you are a closed talker, you're going to be like, and they'll probably be like this. And so what I find to work that works well is if someone's standing there, that's where they're comfortable. So I can choose to match that, to mirror that. If someone comes in to give you a handshake and they're extending their hand, I go in neutral. I don't crush their hand and I don't do the dead fish either. But the dead fish is only a dead fish to you if you're used to people having a firm handshake. For some people, they were raised to shake hands like that. And if anybody ever shake your hand like that, they probably don't want to be shaking your hand. So mirroring is really important. Going in neutral. Same thing with eye contact. You're trying to establish eye contact with people if they're avoiding. Maybe it's a sign of respect or disrespect one way or the other. Mirroring is another thing that we do with gestures. So the dead fish handshake, if you have somebody who shakes your hand limply, it's not whether it's appropriate or not. I would really look at where and why do you feel, not you personally, but why does someone feel they have to shake hands a certain way? I was taught to do a firm handshake by my father. But I'm putting that on everybody I meet. You will have a firm handshake. You will have a firm handshake. And if you give me the dead fish, I will judge you. Dead fish. I don't know. Not confident. Right? So I will really look at that. That is probably appropriate in many contexts to have more of a relaxed handshake. Just note whose hand you're shaking. if you go in neutral and someone is going to be a firm handshake, I firm up. If they're more relaxed, then I'm more relaxed. Those are one of the things that I see. Cool. Another thing that just happened, when I asked the question, I waited a certain amount of time because silence is another dimension of culture. And your personal comfort level with silence changes depending on how you're programmed. In the United States, people get uncomfortable after how many seconds of silence? 1.5 and 2. And then what do you do if you're uncomfortable with silence after 1.5 or 2? Laugh, fidget, make some noise, do something. You actually ask the question at second 5.5. Now, if I'm a presenter or facilitator and I'm like, any questions? If I do my default, any questions? Okay, moving on. And I just missed his question, which was a really good question. So again, we tend to put our own culture onto everybody we meet when we don't know that we don't know. I was doing a workshop in Japan last year and I asked the same question, how many seconds are you comfortable in waiting? And one woman raised her hand after about 10 seconds and she said, about 30. That was her comfort level. So we see conference calls where someone's like, hey, can we get an update on that report? Hey, you guys there? You still there? We just asked you about the report. What's going on? What's going on with that? I don't know the report. What the F? What's happening? Yeah, what's going on? No, nothing, nothing. And on the other line, they're like, why don't you just wait 7 seconds? But think about it in a sales situation or a situation where you want to influence somebody and you're talking to them and you're like, yeah, so what do you think about this? Because we got lots of other things too. If you want to look at this one or this one or that one, that could help maybe. What do you think about this? That's the other thing. When we get silence, very often we think the person doesn't understand. And what do? We tend to repeat the question louder and slower too. You looking home? No. We don't encourage people to do either of those things. But the gesture is important. Everything comes down to icebergs. What you see above the waterline is what we all make judgments on. I see you smile at an interview. He seems cool. I see you not smile at an interview. Maybe a little, not so much. Okay. I see you sitting like this. I see you sitting like that. I see you doing those things. And because of my values, beliefs, or norms, or the way I was brought up, or my programming, right away, I make a judgment. Good, bad, ugly, smart, whatever it is. Once we discover what these are for us, they enable us to understand really what we're seeing. They also then allow us to say, hey, how could other people see that same behavior? And that gives you the ability to have a high global IQ. And in this new global era, having a high global IQ is really the path to success, one of them. And having a high global IQ doesn't mean you know the capital of Burkina Faso. What it means is you know yourself. You have a high level of self-awareness. You understand your cultural programming. So when you're in situations that might be culture crashes, you first recognize how you're feeling. And we'll just do a handshake. Okay, I'm used to the firm handshake, but this person's giving me the dead fish. I'm feeling a little uncomfortable right now. But before I pull back or try to firm up, I'm going to open my mind because I have a high global IQ. And I'm going to go, I wonder what this person's intention is right now. Is it to make me feel uncomfortable? Did they wake up this morning and go, when I meet Michael, I'm going to give him the dead fish handshake just to make him feel uncomfortable? And in that sense, the answer is no. So then I'm going to identify how I can change my style at that point. So rather than firm up, I'm going to match the dead fish and probably show respect that way. Again, high global IQ. Recognizing your reactions in the moment, opening your mind to different ways of thinking or acting, and then identifying your responses. It's what we call the cultural ROI, and it's what I cover in the book. Also in the book, we talk about a couple of spectrums. In addition to the smiling, right, and the silence and the gestures, we talk about me versus we, which is individualism versus collectivism, group orientation versus individual orientation. And this spectrum goes from people to regions, to countries, to organizations. But it's very interesting to note where you fit on this. Because if you were raised in a more group-oriented culture, some of the behaviors from a me-oriented culture are very difficult to adapt to, and vice versa. Where do you think the United States ranks from me to we? Me. The biggest me culture in the world. For the last 30 years, research, no joke, right? It's all about me. When I was a little boy in second grade, I think there was show and tell, right? I brought my bunny in. I'd go, this is my bunny. He's blue and I love him. That was it, okay? My daughter's 7, and last year in first grade, she had All About Me Week. My nephew, who's 12, had All About Me Day. Now it's turned into a week. I'm guessing the next generation is going to have an All About Me Month. Maybe Athos will be All About Me Month. Think about that. What does that say? Star of the week. It's all about you. It's great. We put this picture together. It's awesome. But what's the message? It's all about you. It's all about the individual. Think about it from a marketing standpoint. What's McDonald's big campaign? I'm loving it. Not you. I am loving it. Burger King, have it your way. Not her way, not his way, your way. Army, be all that you can be. Be all that you can be. Budweiser's the what? It's the king of beers. It's not the prince. It's not the popper. It's not the queen. It's the king. It's the best. We want to know who the MVP is. And what are these lovely devices called? It's an Apple device. iPhones. They're not called WePhones. Okay? You iChat on your iPhone, but in China, what's the number one messaging service? WeChat, right? Is that coincidence? No, it isn't. Okay? So MeWe is a big one. Say what? Direct versus indirect. Think about it. You're getting a ride home from somebody, nighttime. They don't turn the lights on their car. They're driving. What would the majority of you say when you got in the car? Dude, turn the lights on, right? Direct culture. Indirect culture might say something like this. Oh, it's very dark outside tonight. Translation, turn your lights on. You might have people in your family who are more direct or indirect, depending. And they probably drive you crazy, but you might drive them crazy as well. What's not being said, we talk about nonverbals. Now versus later, time, right? Time segmentation is very interesting across cultures. My wife and I have a very different time segmentation, especially in this country. If I'm 5 minutes late to a social function, that's 5 segments of time for me, so I get a little bit stressed out. For her, 10 minutes is probably 1 segment of time. So she's like, what's the big deal? And in studies that they've done, you see that across cultures. So it's important to know, what is yours and what are other people's? Because some people, 30 minutes might be 1 segment of time, but that might be 30 segments of time for you, right? So again, time's really interesting on how we organize it, our view of punctuality. And the other thing that we talk about is respect, rank, and ritual, which is all about formality. From how you would handle a business card, to how you would address a letter, to how you would call somebody by a title, Mr. or Ms., how long you would call them by that, to how you would dress, all these things around formality. Again, the United States, Silicon Valley in particular, super informal culture. Call me Bob. Call me Jane, real quick. Mr. Landers, that was my father, right? We want to get to those things quickly. But by doing that, sometimes we ostracize other people. They're like, wait a minute, you got too informal too quickly, especially with texting, social media, super informal from our end. And sometimes that makes people think different things about you. Our intentions are not necessarily aligned with the impact that they have. So those are a couple of things that we take a look at in the book, get a little bigger idea of who you are and why you do what you do. Self-awareness, really, I find to be one of the biggest keys to having a more peaceful society. And discovering the key to making successful connections in this new global era starts with your awareness of yourself.